Hello, and welcome to the Courtney Turner Radio Hour on Worldwide Radio, WWCR. It is Monday the 11th, and we are continuing this series. We've been going into the roots of the school choice agenda, the history of the exportation of the Prussian model of education, the, what do they call it, the Wundtianization of America. And we have a very special guest with us today, my friend John Kleisig. I've had him on the Courtney Turner podcast before. He is the author of this incredible book, School World Order. It is the technocratic globalization of corporatized education, and it is a wealth of information, phenomenal research. So I highly recommend you read that. And we're going to talk, he personally knew Charlotte Iserbeet. I think I said it right this time, did I?
Yep.
So he actually introduced me to a lot of her backstory, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. I want to let you all know that we are doing this for the radio, but I am filming it as well, so it will be on my channel at CourtneyTurner.com. And again, for those who are listening, I spell my name a little bit differently. It's like Courtenay, so CourtenayTurner. And you can find all of my episodes there. We're going to cut this off at the hour for the radio show. And then if we continue, you can find the rest of the episode there. And there's all sorts of ways you can support the podcast and support the radio show at CourtneyTurner.com. We have direct kind of support like Give, Send, Goes, a Venmo. You can do a P.O. Box letter. You can just send me nice words. I like that too. Any kind of feedback, things you'd like to see less of. All of that is well appreciated as well. And the P.O. Box is 680093, Franklin, Tennessee, 37068. Again, that is P.O. Box 680093, Franklin, Tennessee, 37068. And you can find all sorts of other, if you want to just buy products that you like, you can do that as well. So, well, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Likewise. So, for those who are not familiar, I do recommend you go back, and we don't want to take up too much time, but maybe give a little bit of intro to why you even wrote this book, what your introduction to this whole topic was.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, I'm an adjunct professor, and I was also working with an online tutoring company, so there's a few things that was going on. I want to say 2015, 2016, this is a time when in Illinois, where I teach, Bruce Rauner was the governor, and he was basically stalling on the budget, and I saw this as a ploy to basically push public institutions into private receivership, including the school system, and he was a big charter school proponent. He was a proponent of all the things that I'd heard Charlotte Thompson Iserbeet talk about, so that includes charter schools, voucher programs, cradle to career, workforce training. And so first I wrote an article basically breaking down what I thought was his ploy to push public schools into a school choice model. And I wrote this article, and Charlotte somehow came across it. And then she reached out to me and basically encouraged me to keep writing. So the chapter turned into a book, which basically goes through the history of, it starts with the privatization of education through the school choice movement, mm-hmm. And then through the public-private partnerships. I look at how those integrate education technologies that sort of go from a scale of adaptive learning courseware to socio-emotional learning, biofeedback wearables, and then eventually looking at how these two devices are used to data mine students to develop artificial intelligence, social credit databases, and then to interface the students into the AI with the brain-computer interface. And some of my insight into the edtech part had to do with when I was tutoring with a particular online company. And I saw that IBM's Watson was piloting with us to basically data mine us. So this is sort of the context for how this book came about.
Awesome. So what would you say that you feel like the ultimate goal is of the school choice agenda?
So it's basically to create one system. Mm-hmm. So basically, as all the woke stuff gets out of control, the parents are going to be sort of incentivized to move out of the public system into a private system. But that private system, since it's going to be subsidized by government money, means it comes with government regulations, which means that actually the private schools will become public, or at least government controlled. And so at that point, now you basically have one system.
And you have all the children under the control of that system.
Yeah. And so, you know, not just government control, but right. The model is the public private partnership, which, mm-hmm. you know, we call it stakeholder capitalism these days. Yes. So it's also right. corporations running right. Your public schools, and it's government running your private schools. And both of those sort of mixed into what Linda Darling Hammond called a portfolio model of school choice, with what you call diverse providers. And the diverse providers are not DEI, like diversities of ethnic and gender identities. It's a diversity of community schools, public schools, charter schools, and private schools that take vouchers.
Right. Yeah. So I've been down to the Capitol a couple of times past month. I will be going back, the state Capitol. And the pushback that I got, they're really pushing for the school choice in Tennessee. And for those who are not familiar, Tennessee is considered to be a red state, a quote-unquote conservative state. And we have a large majority of Republicans in the legislature. However, they're very pro-school choice. And actually, the Democrats are not. They're against it. And so what I kept hearing from them was, I don't understand why you're fighting us. We're the good guys. The Democrats are the bad guys. We're the good guys. And so you should be with us on this. And, you know, I tried to explain to them, well, there's a, you know, this is basically the Hegelian dialectic in practice, in practical application. Of course, they mocked me and told me I was using big words that they didn't understand. And that, you know, that was not appropriate. But that is, it's very, very interesting to me, because they don't see that at all. They really see it as, you know, we're the good guys. We've gotten these marching orders and we have to execute. And they're, I think some of them have been co-opted. We now have some footage that's been released that shows that, you know, they, this guy Phil got footage of them saying, pretty, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially it was, you know, if you're not with us on this, then your political career is over. And he played the voiceover in this. And we saw Pat Marsh going around, because I went to, you know, the subcommittee meeting, the hearing, and we saw him going around to each of them and whispering in their ear. So it kind of seems like that, I can't prove that's who it was who was speaking, but it all seems to follow that's a plausible explanation for what was going on. But some of the others, so while I say, you know, some of them, that there's definitely corruption, I think, afoot, but there's some who I think are really just kind of naively convinced that this is the, you know, this is how it works. We're the Republicans, we're doing good, we're, you know, increasing choice for everyone, we're giving more opportunities. I kept hearing that we have to make sure every child has an opportunity to be educated. And of course, you know, I argued my reasons why that's not valid and actually not even constitutional. But they really come to this mindset. So yeah, I'm curious, can you talk about from the origins of this mission, and, you know, do you see that as part of the strategy and, you know, how that's being played out now?
Yeah, I brought some files that Charlotte had collected. So for those who don't know, she worked in the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan, and she blew the whistle on something called Project BEST. That's Basic Education Skills Through Technology. And she worked in several divisions in her, it was the office of, she was a special advisor in the Office of Educational Research and Improvement, OERI. But there were several divisions under there. So one of them was school choice. Okay. But she collected tons of documents. There was like 13 file cabinets full, like 34 drawers full. And so I had stacks and stacks on school choice and various other education related policies. So I brought some stuff here from her collection, and I thought we would go through a little bit of the history.
Straight from the horse's mouth.
The original, one of the first experiments with public funding of private education actually occurred in Vichy, France. And this is a publication by Phi Delta Kappan. Okay, so this is from I don't know the year on it. I'd say it was somewhere around the 80s or the 90s. And what happened would later on would be that when a particular socialist leader came in, I can't remember the guy's name right now, but what happened was they basically said, well, this is a travesty that, you know, we're providing public funds to these private schools. So basically, and a lot of them were religious schools, so they were basically mm-hmm. church schools. If you were taking money, right, they basically took over those schools. So this is like, you know, when we're talking about school choice sort of being a trap to basically control the private schooling system, mm-hmm. it's not just theoretical that this could happen. Like, this has happened historically in the past. So that's actually like the first model. Milton Friedman was also involved in proposing the idea of a voucher system. The voucher system, really, some of the early iterations of the voucher system were in the 1970s. So what I have here is
And it was Milton Friedman who is advocating this.
Yeah, I just want to,
before you explain, because this is really interesting, because I talk a lot about how, you know, some of the, you know, they create these, what I think are intentional dialectics for, you know, the purposes of dialectical progression, as opposed to natural opposition. And you see that in economic theory. I've talked about how, like, you know, they had von Hayek opposing Keynes, and, you know, both of them are kind of predicated on Marx and Adam Smith, who, of course, were predicated on, what am I blanking on his name, but he was a, oh, I'm totally blanking on his name. But he was essentially a Luciferian. It was this whole idea of like a virtue through sin. I'm totally blanking.
Oh, are you talking about Sabbatai Zevi? You're going way back?
No. Although that would make sense. But no, I'm totally blanking on who his influence was. I think it started with a B. I'm going to look it up, because that's going to drive me absolutely bonkers.
Well, while you do that,
yeah.
Yeah, so I found a date on this. It's on the back. So this is January 1987. And I'll just read you a little portion of it here. It says, one interesting aspect of the French experiment is that it has been run twice with somewhat different results each time. The first trial occurred between 1940 and 1944 under the Vichy regime. After France's defeat by Germany, her leaders fastened on public education as a convenient scapegoat. And in an atmosphere of vicious attack against the public schools and their teachers, officials of the Vichy government granted subsidies to private education. At the same time, they outlawed the major teachers' unions and imprisoned their leaders. Not surprisingly, the percentage of French children enrolled in public school dropped from 81% in 1939 to 77% at the end of the war. So you see what you'll also note here in this little passage is, right, something that goes along with some of the push for school of choice, which is, right, the anti-union sentiment, right? And mm-hmm. so I am a union guy. Like, I believe in organized labor, but I've written extensively about how the teachers unions especially are not representing us. And for those that don't know, actually, it was Albert Schenker who was the president of the American Federation of Teachers for 20 some odd years. He's the one that sort of came up with what we now know as the school choice model, right? So basically building off of Milton Friedman's ideas and others, he's the guy that sort of piloted this idea. So this has actually been promoted by unions or some of the union leaders in different phases. And actually, Randy Weingarten, who is the current president of the AFT, she actually ran a charter school when she was working at the UFT, United Federation of Teachers. So there's a long history of the so-called left actually being involved in the charter school movement. And if you check out my series called Teachnocracy on Unlimited Hangout, you'll also see how there's lots of corporate partnerships between the unions and some big tech companies, foundations, etc. So again, right, this idea that unions are like, you know, on the left and they're anti-capitalist, anti-corporate, it's not the case, right?
I can't find it. It'll come back to me. But I point out that, you know, the last chapter of Road to Serfdom, and I get pushback on this all the time, but when you read it, he very clearly says that you know, the solution would be to create an internationalist world order. And now, I mean, he didn't see it necessarily the way someone like Klaus Schwab sees it today, but he was suggesting that that would be a solution to a lot of the problems, is to have this, you know, and but people see him as like the, you know, pro-individual liberty, very, you know, laissez-faire economics, Austrian economics guy. Yeah. And not to say that, you know, he didn't have some very valid, great ideas. And that doesn't negate the whole, you know, all the other chapters in his book, which there was a lot of really great things in there. But yeah, I feel like people just conveniently want to overlook that last chapter. And so it's interesting to hear that that was, I didn't know that about Milton Friedman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It says here, this is another piece. I'm not sure what the publication is, but it was written by Peter A. Jansen. And he was a former education editor of Newsweek and was the White House correspondent for a television station WETA in Washington. He was also the president of the Education Writers Association. And he traces some of the early, so he notes Milton Friedman here. He says, the voucher system is supported by liberals and conservatives alike, ranging from psychologist Kenneth Clark and critic Paul Goodman to conservative economist Milton Friedman. And I don't know if I have a date on this, so I'm not quite sure when, but it's within the same pack that it was filed away with all the other stuff on vouchers. But something else that's worth noting in here is that one of the early studies of the voucher concept was developed at something called the Center for the Study of Public Policy in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right? And this is basically a very left-leaning institution, right? So the origins again, right? Right now, you're not going to see a lot of, you know, you're not going to see the type, the Shankers and the Weingartens basically promote it. But you can mark my words that if the school choice thing gets big enough and they get enough people into that system, all they'll need to do is cry foul and say, we need to get unions and regulations in there. And then basically it'll be a done deal.
Yeah. So Mandeville, that was who it was. Mandeville. Yeah. But it's essentially in this idea of like virtue through sin. That's why Smith's whole principle was that greed is good. It's good for capitalism because it incentivizes people to work hard and to, you know, motivates them. But that's essentially, it's like virtue through sin. So,
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. He was very influenced by Mandeville. And then, you know, so you have the next tier, which would be Keynes and Hayek, who are really drawing mostly from Marx and Smith. And so the ladder goes up, but you're now creating this illusion of them being polar opposites when they're drawing from, that doesn't mean they agreed with each other 100%. You know, I'm saying that they didn't have very fundamental differences in their line of thought, but their roots are very similar, which I think is very, you know, this I think Sutton does a really good job of illustrating in The Order when he talks about how, you know, there's the left Hegelians, the right Hegelians, but essentially they all agree that the state is God, the state is all powerful, and the goal is to achieve, with, you know, by the Hegelian principle of freedom through subservience to the state.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I was going to also, I wanted to show you something here. This was, we were talking about Charlotte and, you know, her legacy and all that. And, what I have here is a series of articles written by a woman named Mary Thompson. And this was one of Charlotte's good friends. They knew each other forever. I'm not sure if she's still around, but Charlotte has, if you go on her YouTube, there's the Global Road to Ruin. She did a little conference at her house and had several people speak there. Rosa Quarry spoke there.
Oh, wow.
And Mary Thompson is one of them. And what I have here is basically some early pilots for voucher programs. There's a PTA meeting. No, here's a little pamphlet they had for it. This was in Alum Rock Union District in, I believe it's in San Jose, California. Here was like some testimony based on the draft legislation. And then I have several articles here from Mary Thompson in the, I think it's the San Jose Mercury. Is it the Mercury Sun or just the San Jose Mercury? These are, this one is 10/21/1971.
Wow.
And she's got several of them here. So, and she as well, right, traced it back to, you know, the Center for Public Policy that I just mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. And so she, but there's a, there was a good quote in here that I wanted to read you. And she basically lays it out exactly what is the end game. So it says there could be no more effective way to remove that freedom of choice than to provide state money for private education. No matter how disguised or by what circuitous route the funding is channeled, such as vouchers, state money is tax money imposed by and carrying the power of the state. Once any school's existence comes dependent on the state for sustenance, that school has forfeited its right to be called private. The state, by virtue of supplying the funding, ultimately will conformatize education via control of private school teacher training and credentialing as other states are experiencing. And then it goes on from there. So, but so there are several articles. What I'll do is I'll scan these when I get back.
Okay, yeah.
And I'll put them on my database and I'll probably tweet some of them out. So if anybody wants to see it, they can go see it.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'll repost that. So for Charlotte, I've played some of the clips in the previous episodes and, you know, I've started watching some of her videos and she's very passionate about this whole thing. You said that she was the whistleblower for BEST, right? Mm-hmm. Was that her first introduction to all of this or what spawned her journey?
No, so a lot of people don't know that she actually worked in the State Department prior to getting involved in education. So the first thing she did, she went to the Red Cross. This was, I want to say, 50s? Maybe it was 40s. Probably 50s. She was born in 1930. So I'm going to guess it was late 40s, early 50s. Then she went to the State Department. She worked in Middle Eastern Affairs. She worked in Soviet Affairs. When she worked in Soviet Affairs...
And that was the connection she had with Sutton, right? A lot of that research, the Soviet Affairs.
Yeah. I'm not sure how he came on her radar. But you know what I do have is I have like their correspondence, like letters they wrote each other.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, I'll scan some of those.
Okay.
We're in the editing process, but I did a lecture series with Richard Groves, Autonomy University.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I was just on his VIP series.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't go. I saw that, but I wanted to check it out, but I didn't get to. And I actually, in the first lecture in the series, I actually show some of those letters. So, but I should scan them and put them on the database and share.
Yeah.
Them.
Okay.
So I don't know how she.
Well, she said in one of the interviews that, you know, she had been doing some research on Soviet affairs and he was working for, I think, was it the Hoover Institute?
Yeah.
And that was his focus, was on the Cold War.
Right.
And so they had been exchanging information on that and then led to the Skull and Bones stuff. And he was writing a book and she was like, I have the black book. Yeah.
He wrote the Soviet... Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, three-volume series. That's basically what got him fired. And, you know, he'd found that, you know, one of the people at on the board at the Hoover Institute was David Packard, who was Trilateral Commission. He also was, I think, Deputy Secretary of Defense at one point, right, head of the Hewlett-Packard Computer Corporation. But he sort of went on this journey to figure out, like, who did I upset? Like, right. Who were the men behind the curtain, as Charlotte's son would call them? And that led him to be interested in the order. And then, Charlotte sent him the address books, the catalogs, rather. Mm-hmm. I always call them address books. Mm-hmm. They don't actually have specific addresses in there. But they'll tell you where they live in terms of the, are they in, you know, New York City, et cetera, so you know if
State
they're close
City.
By. But it's got a list of their family members and all of their different credentials and titles. So, you know, are you looking for a lawyer? Are you looking for an engineer? It's sort of a networking book.
A Rolodex of sorts.
Yeah. And so she sent them to him. He scanned them, sent them back. I have those now. So when she passed away, she gave me her entire library and all of her files. So I have those three catalogs.
Wow.
Not sure how they... ultimately, but that's probably what it was. It's probably the Soviet stuff. But so back to your first question was, she encountered, there was a few stories she told where she encountered people that had, that were escaping some of the Soviet countries. So she was in Korea at one point. And she talked to somebody that told a story of how one guy that was really smart, they beheaded him and put his head on a pike and marched it around. And another guy that they thought was really smart, anybody that was too smart, they didn't really want around. Mm-hmm. And see, this guy was a pianist, and mm-hmm. they said they cut his hands off. And when they put the guy's head on the pike, they said it was to scare off the resistors. So when she came back to the United States, so she was gone for probably a decade or more. When she came back, she started to attend school board stuff or mm-hmm. PTA or whatever it was. She wasn't elected to the board yet. This is what inspired her to get elected to the school board, and I believe it was Camden, Maine. And she said something to the effect of, there was like a little round table, and they said, "What do you think people should learn in school?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "Well, I think they should learn, you know, good values, you know." And she said, "Everybody goes, whose values?" Right. Mm-hmm. And she was like, "Have I been away this long? Like, what do you mean? Like, don't we believe in the Constitution? And we all have relatively Christian values, right?" Like, and so somebody at the meeting, or knew that she attended the meeting, said, "You know, you're on to something, but I don't think you quite know how much you're on to. So mm-hmm. I'm going to pay for you to do what's called change agent training." And the guy that was running it was Ronald Havelock. He's the one that has this, so she calls it the Green Book. And mm-hmm. I have the Green Book that she bought, right? So, I mean, not just a copy, but I have the one that she had from the conference. And on that Richard Grove lecture, I show some of the diagrams mm-hmm. from it. But basically, the change agents were people that were to get into the school system and sort of infiltrate it and invert the value system. And one of the things in the Green Book was how to identify the resistors of the change. And to her, that resonated with, like, you know, because spending so much time in Soviet affairs, you know, and this is Cold War era, yeah. right? This is during the time when, you know, when we look at conspiracy now, we mm-hmm. don't look at it like it's just communism. But back then, like, you know, McCarthy era, most people, mm-hmm. when they saw this type of infiltration and this subversion going on, they sort of always, right, it was the Soviets. It was the right. Soviets. And so that was sort of the hermeneutics. And so that was what got her to run for school board. And then she eventually got elected. And then she used that. She founded something called Guardians of Education for Maine, called GEMS is the acronym. Mm-hmm. And eventually she used that to get herself into the Department of Education. And there was a funny story. She's telling stories about, she worked under Donald Sinise, and he was an assistant secretary of education under T.H. Bell. Mm-hmm. And she said when she got picked, he asked her, "Are you going to be loyal?" Mm-hmm. And she says, "Well, I thought he meant, am I going to be loyal to the Constitution? So I said, yes." But right. I think she meant, am I going to be loyal to Ronald Reagan? Which turned out to, I guess, not be the case.
Right.
But she actually was a big Reagan fan mm-hmm. in the beginning. And she had a lot of friends that were telling her, like, he's not what you think. Gary Arnold was one of them. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a book she's talking about. It's called Here's the Rest of Them. And it's about Reagan. It's a little thing. Mm-hmm. And it was basically like all of his very, very left-leaning, basically pinko policies mm-hmm. as governor and all that beforehand. And she, you know, she said, she wanted to listen to him.
Right.
But she's like, you know.
Don't burst my bubble. Yeah, don't kill my hero.
Yeah. And when she got in the department, first of all, he ran on getting rid of it, right? Mm-hmm. He was supposed to, it was only...
Like Woodrow Wilson running on not getting us into war, and then he enters us into World War One, like that? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. You know, because it would have been a perfect time, because it hadn't even been barely a year old, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, so it's not like, you know, we've got all these programs that are tied to it now. Right. It's a little bit of a different animal to just, you know, abolish it like it would have been then. But it wasn't just that he didn't abolish it. It was that in addition to sort of this corporatist public-private partnership school choice stuff, which there's a story she used to tell where she was in a meeting where they were talking about school choice and mm-hmm. public-private partnership. She goes, wasn't that like corporate fascism? And she said, well, gee, Charlotte, we never thought about it like that. Right? But in addition to that, there was, you know, a lot of still what back then was known as values clarification. This was basically like sort of a precursor to what we now know as social emotional learning and its intersection with like identity politics. So values clarification, which was this process, this dialectical process by which you engage the students into questioning their values in order to basically, you know, create an open space to sort of inject new values. And we sort of see the culmination of that with, right, these new DEI woke identity politic type of values, right? But first they had to get rid of
trans stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that stuff, right? So yeah, go ahead. I felt like I'm going on and on.
Yeah, no, this is great. So much information. Yeah, so she,
values clarification. Sydney Simon was one of the main proponents of it. And go ahead. You were going to ask.
So at that time, that's what they were calling it, and then she was finding out about this, and then how did that lead her to?
Well, it was still.
You were saying that she was really a big fan of Reagan, and then she was,
Yeah, so he was not just continuing the department, but was, you know, there's a lot of like left wing pedagogy curriculum stuff that was being funded, right? So, and then I think ultimately the nail in the coffin for her support of Reagan was ultimately Project Best. So it came across her desk and she saw this, major technology initiative. It's basically laid the groundwork for everything that's going on now. So it was to set up public-private partnerships between public schools and technology corporations to implement computerized learning that would condition students for workforce training using B.F. Skinner's operant conditioning algorithms.
Yeah.
So she blew the whistle on that, they got she sent it to Human Events in 1981. And then that sort of led her on the rest of this journey. So,
wow. And Human Events was, whose paper was that?
They still have a paper.
Do they?
Yeah. It's, it was a little better back then. I mean, the fact that they published her.
Yeah. I was surprised that you said they published it.
Yeah. I don't know that they're quite as intrepid journalism as they used to be. I know that Charlotte didn't speak quite as highly of them in the later years. So, but it's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, 1944.
Okay.
It became digital publication in 2013. Okay. And the founders were Felix Morley, Frank Hannigan, and Henry Regnery. I don't know how you say that. And the editor in chief was Will Chamberlain.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay. Interesting. Well, I feel like back then they were just much more transparent. You know, I think we were talking a little bit about the national training labs and how Emory created the sensitivity training, which is now what they use in all the corporations. Yeah. And back then they literally called it brainwashing. Yeah. And of course, now they call it sensitivity training, and it's politically correct woke nonsense, but that was, and I know that Fred Emery was an Australian psychologist, and he did work for Tavistock, and National Training Labs was Kurt Lewin's group training projects.
Yeah, you just reminded me. One of the other things that got her sort of off the Reagan train was. He signed agreements with the Soviet Union, education agreements, right? And there was also during this time, there was, which is interesting. There was these through like Esalen, there was these Soviet American dialogues, and Barbara Marx Hubbard was a part of that. This is around the same time. Barbara Marx Hubbard was a founder of the World Future Society. And I have a file, it's on my database where, Reagan attended a World Future Society event with Bush. So, you know, it's just an interesting kind of way that circle kind of comes back around like that. But the reason I thought about it was because there was also something called Educators for Social Responsibility. It still exists, but it's called something else now. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but they were also doing Soviet American exchange programs, and they were also heavily involved in basically sensitivity training, but it was called like conflict resolution training. It's for workplace.
Right.
Stuff, right. Yeah.
Right. Because Tavistock created the basically what we now call organizational psychology.
Yeah.
Yeah. They called it, what did they call it? Like operational training back then.
Right.
I have one of their first books. It's really big. And that's what they called it, the operational training manual. That's really interesting. So for those who don't know, EST, the Esalen program. Yeah, that's basically what Landmark is now. You know the Landmark Forum?
Yeah.
So there's a Landmark Forum, and now there's all these other little offshoots, you know, that they have franchised, and other, you know, quote unquote independent have created these little their group training program, the international all around the world, but they really started with Esalen. And it's essentially like communist training grounds. And I think Charlotte even says it where she said it in one of the speeches I played where but part of their strategy was to create these like replicate basically like group therapy dynamics, because then you spill all of your secrets. And now of course you're beholden to these people because they know so much about you. And so now they obviously have lever of power over you. And that's essentially what they do with these groups. They, I've done two of them. I haven't done Landmark. Landmark is kind of the more like well-known, and they consider it like more legitimate because it has an actual course catalog, whereas a lot of these other ones, it's really just like this step-by-step. You have to go through different levels and then you train others. But it is this group dynamic thing. Both of the ones I did, and they were on different sides of the country, but they both played the song Imagine every time you walked in the room and every time you left, and they'd have everybody hold hands. But it does come out of S and this whole idea of gestalt therapy and to create the, like a collective conscious where everybody, strips their own personal identity so they can bond with the group. And this was all part of, you know, all of the Tavistock group training, research that they did. But the goal was to create this identity politics and brainwash people and strip people of their identity so that they would be more malleable and suggestible.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that at Esalen as well, and I wrote a piece looking at sort of Barbara Marx Hubbard's connection to a lot of this stuff. There was a guy that was doing a workshop in, I want to say like 2016, 2017 at Esalen. His name's Mikey Siegel. He's rubs elbows with Elon Musk and some other Silicon Valley types, but he has something, a wearable, biofeedback wearable that is called HeartSync, I think is what it's called.
There's HeartSync
and HeartMath. And HeartMath is a really popular one they actually use in the schools. It's one of the counseling or mental health centers at one of the schools where I teach. I imagine it's probably right now they probably focus on like, so what you do is you put this thing on and you do a meditation, which are trademarked, by the way, the
of
heart,
course,
like, you know, your breathing technique is trademarked. And so you
didn't know how to breathe before. Somebody had to come up with a patent in order for you to be able to breathe properly.
Well, because it's like an MLM model where, so they have like these, so you sell the wearable and then you coach people in the so the whole thing is like a pyramid scheme basically and so you put this thing on, you do the meditation, you breathe, and then your it tells you when your heart is in the appropriate rhythm or wavelength. Mikey Siegel piloted some of this stuff. He called it hacking the name of the conference was Hacking Consciousness, but he proposed it for workplace. So, like, before you go to a board meeting, right, everybody gets in heart coherence. So that way when the board director comes out and gives you the agenda, everybody's like, oh, we're all on the same page, right? Like, getting everybody effectively on the same wavelength, right, helps reinforce the whole Delphi technique, sort of, you know, the artificial consensus building, right, as opposed to just the peer pressure method. So,
Interesting. Yeah, it's so interesting that there's like the ones that are pushed into the forefront, like a lot of these technical devices, like the example I'm thinking of is yesterday they were talking about Elon Musk's like Neuralink, right? And I feel like everybody's heard of that, nobody talks about the fact that BlackRock has neurotech, and they've already done 30,000 kind of experiments with it. Okay. Elon's done one. So, okay. Yeah.
So is that BlackRock? Is that the same? Because I saw that. But is it the same BlackRock? I didn't.
It is. It's
the same.
It's BlackRock.
Okay, the asset management company. Okay.
I'll double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's BlackRock.
Okay. But I saw it a while back, and it wasn't clear to me that it seemed like it had its own, certainly had its own page, but I wasn't sure if it was.
You can see this, but it says BlackRock Neurotech, Move Again BCI System, Pioneering the Future. BlackRock Neurotech is the team, the world's leading engineers, neuroscientists, and visionaries. Together, we've developed the most powerful neurotechnology platform that improves patients' lives today.
That one's called the Utah Array. That design there with the spikes on it.
Oh.
There's different kinds. Like, so Elon's is a graphene base. Right. It's going to sew it thread by thread. That thing is literally like a thumbtack.
Yeah.
And it says, if you look up the prototypes, it says, well, this is like the least ideal because it tends to inflame and scar the brain.
Can't imagine why.
I mean, it's not funny. It's
well, I'll post a link to this. When we release this, you can go look at the visual if you want. It's not pretty.
Yeah. And they have one that's called a Stentrode too.
Yes.
So it goes up through your artery instead of drilling a hole in your head and having a port back. So it's supposed to be less invasive, although
less invasive.
I have to say anything inside.
This is right next year. Yeah. Right. Neck veins. Yeah. That seems very uninvasive. Sure. But yeah, I feel like it's interesting that they always, they have like one that they really push, but then there's so many others. Cause this is, that's obviously been in the works for a lot longer. And it's the same kind of, different modality, but similar technology, similar goal in the technology. Interesting, you're saying the graphene. I recently learned that there's graphene in, somebody did this study where they were analyzing like the ingredients of Botox, and it has graphene oxide in it. That's what they found.
I wonder why. Like, what would be the...
Well, I don't know, except that I feel like they're doing all sorts of experimentation. So that would be a really great way to kind of capture a very different market.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I can speculate, but I have no idea what the reason for it is. But well, I don't think people expect that when they're like.
Yeah. Well, all this stuff goes way back, like you're mentioning. Yeah. Like, so the first neural implants are in the 1960s with Jose Manuel Rodriguez Delgado out of Yale, right? He's putting them in bulls and monkeys. He put them in mental patients. There's actually a skull and bones connection to him. And I can't remember. So there's an article that's on my website, and the title is something like A Free Market Future of Brain-Computer Interfaces. I wrote it quite a while ago. But there was several people around Delgado while he was at Yale doing his experiments. I can't remember. One of them was last name Ashton. You have to check out the article. It's not something that I've spoken about enough where I can remember the name, but there's three bonesmen. One of them was the treasurer at the time. Another one set up the, a council that was basically oversaw the science departments and the medical departments. And then one of his partners who helped him do some of these experiments on the mental patients was Hannibal Hamlin. Mm-hmm. And his son he wasn't in the order, but his son is. Mm-hmm. And he's also a neurosurgeon that works on hands. Does operations for nerve problems in people's hands, promotes stem cell stuff like that. But the wearables we were talking about go back to the 70s as well. And so Charlotte, I wrote a series on UNESCO for Unlimited Hangout. And then I did a video, sort of a follow-up video on some of that stuff. But the files in there I got from Charlotte, and she got them from a guy named Lawrence P. Grayson, and he was the UNESCO liaison with the Department of Education while she was there. And I have a bunch of his papers. And one of them was warning about fMRI helmets in the 1970s.
Wow.
And was, so basically the technology had been there.
Yeah.
And he was just talking about, the implications of that in terms of like privacy and all that type of stuff. So, sure. You know, again, all this stuff is, you know, we're basically past the prototype phase, but now we're in the, like, you know, pilot commercially available phase right now. So
pilotly commercial available. That's pretty scary.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, he's got, you know, Elon's doing his human tests. I think he did at least one now. So, but you know, as far as like the externals, like, those are, you know, pretty much ready to go. You know what I mean? Right. Like they have, what are they called? BrainCo is a company that does it. And so that's a Chinese. So that is a company, it's called the Focus One Headband. It was designed by Harvard academics in partnership with a Chinese electronics corporation. It's used. I heard that the pilot actually ended in China, and then they're not actually continuing to use it. But you can go on and watch a Wall Street Journal piece on it. If you just type in to YouTube, Wall Street Journal, China BrainCo, you'll get images of it. So,
interesting. So are they using any of this stuff in education already? Or,
well, definitely they use heart math, right? Yeah. And they definitely use that. It seems to be to help students with test anxiety and other, like, it's basically through what are known as wraparound services in the community school model. So, you know, you'd think that a school is supposed to teach academics, right? This is what the institution does. But wraparound services plug in, you know, everything from mental health to, you know, sometimes they'll have food pantries attached. Mm-hmm. It could be workforce training, like internship programs. Sometimes they have a community policing program where they try to catch the kids that are at risk, you know, all this type of stuff. So, but through the counseling departments, through the mental health departments, they like I said, at one of the schools where I teach, they offer workshops on heart math.
Right.
But they also are, you know, because we've talked about sort of the overlap between the school and the workforce and how they go together, and the policies in them are pretty much the same. They've got stuff for people, for employees, called bossware is what they call it. And so some of them are, I think some of them are like ear pods, but it's basically an EEG. It's basically it's not a brain computer interface. Like it's going to plug into your nervous system, but it can read your brain signals, and it can infer, you know, are you paying attention? Are you daydreaming and not doing your job and stuff like that?
Wow.
So
that's so scary. So in one of the clips I was listening to, she was talking about, you know, she called the Communist Core and the origins of that and the Carnegie Foundation documents. And she also talked about how part of this whole agenda was the community service.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so fascinating because I remember I actually went to a private school for high school, but I was required to do community service. And at the time I thought, oh, that's really nice. And I actually really enjoyed what I did. I ended up being like an assistant director for children's theater, musical theater. So I directed all their dances and choreography, and that was really fun. But but to see that there was a whole agenda tied to this, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that largely plugs into the community schooling model. Okay, and so this is sort of like the flip side of the coin of the school choice charter schooling model. So the community school, for in the Every Student Succeeds Act, in order for a community school to be considered a full service community school and receive appropriate the funding as such, it has to have various wraparound services. Sometimes they call them pipeline services, and these are defined as public-private partnerships in the federal legislation. Right. And these include everything from healthcare, workforce training, community oriented policing, and then built into that is the community service model. So that basically we sort of try to make it a learning experience as much as a service experience. You know, get two bangs for your buck or whatever, right? And so that's part of that model. But the interesting thing is you look at it like at this point in the game, where we are today in the political dynamic, the left tends to promote the community schooling model and the wraparound services. The right tends to promote the charter schools, the vouchers, the school choice system. Mm-hmm. But somebody like Linda Darling Hammond, who was an advisor to both President Obama and also an advisor to Biden, who also, by the way, has done work for the RAND Corporation. And I've got a few files here we can maybe chat about as far as RAND Corporation documents promoting, quote unquote, decentralized schools and charter schools as well. Linda Darling-Hammond.
Decentralized, I just want to point that out, is very misleading.
Yeah. And they even say it in here. They basically say, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty much a quote, that decentralized can mean many different things. It could be that there's more power in the hands of the teachers, but it could, or moving power from the state to the principals, or moving principals to teachers or teachers to students. And then they also go, but it doesn't mean that there's not a hierarchy and that there's not some centralized prompt, and that the decentralization has more to do with how you get done the objectives that are laid out by the centralized hierarchy. I mean, it's exactly what it says in this short piece.
Right? Wow.
But she also, so Linda Darling-Hand was a big proponent of the community school model. Yeah. But she also promoted school choice programs. She promoted, she's the woman that I mentioned, wanted to promote the, it's a portfolio approach to, quote, diverse providers. And it's also worth noting the RAND Corporation helped develop something called PPBS. This is Planning, Programming, and Budgeting Systems. And it was first designed for the military. And it was basically, it's a system for central planning and using various financial instruments. And it started in the military, but then they outsourced it to basically every other agency, every other department, including education. And this sort of gives us kind of the framework within which the public, private, community, and school choice partners fit into this PPBS model. So this whole project basically goes back to the RAND Corporation in the military.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question. So why is the RAND Corporation and the military research division, essentially, why are they involved in creating the future planning of education?
Yeah, you might infer that if it's the military, it might have something, there might be some weaponization involved in this, right? But really, I think what they, I guess you can call it, education is a national security issue. So, right, we got to have smart people that can, you know, maintain the economy and can, you know, can keep us afloat in the global dynamic of geopolitics.
And they're going to do this by dumbing down the people who are being trained.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, so
not educated, trained. I was intentional about that word, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we look at the outcomes and we see that, right, that's where it goes, then you, I guess you have to be a little more inclined to think that perhaps this is more of a weaponization as opposed to like a national security strategy to help keep America, you know, strong in the broader geopolitical arena, right? You would assume that that sort of the students are sort of the target of some sort of military operation, let's say.
Yeah. How far along?
Well, I just thought too, you know, some of the early tutoring systems were developed, the early AI tutoring systems or intelligent tutoring systems were developed by Office of the Navy. There was a particular division of the Navy. I can't think of it off the top of my head. So in other words, the military has been involved in not just this, the PPBS and charter schooling and the infrastructure model, but also the education technologies, right? So just worth noting. Yeah,
definitely worth noting. I think we're running out of time for this segment, but I'm very curious about if Charlotte saw any of those connections and what she thought. I'm just kind of trying to think about her thoughts about this tie to, you know, she was learning, I think, through Sutton about Skull and Bones, and she knew about the connection with the RAND Corporation. Do you have any insight into what her thoughts were about the larger geopolitical kind of agenda at that time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, so Charlotte had a lot to say about PPBS. I mean, ultimately, though, I mean, she saw it as essentially, so especially through the school choice movement and the community schooling thing, what you would do is districts would become less relevant and schools would become regionalized based on the corporations that were in partnership with the government. And so they would be involved in a process of regional planning. And she felt like regional planning was a staple of Soviet realpolitik, and that regionalization would lead to globalization. So that this system was designed to remove the authority from elected officials to corporate boards that would then, right, basically from the regional to the national to the supranational, basically, right? It would integrate with other public-private systems and other nations through the companies that would be able to facilitate the contracts through UNESCO, et cetera.
So when she says regional, she's not meaning like a, you know, your county political apparatus.
Yeah, no. The regions, and there was one, I have a document for something back in the 70s in Maine, regional planning in Maine. This is like blocking, you know, several counties together. Sometimes it's, you know, and then it's sort of layered, right? Blocking states together, then blocking, you know, like moving towards an EU system, you know, continentally. And there was once upon a time in the works in going to be an American, North American union that never came about, but it was a legit proposal. I think it was called
the
SPP something in Prosperities was the official name of it. I can't remember.
But it was the North Atlantic Treaty they were trying union that they were trying to.
Oh, I think that sounds more like the TPP. That would be Pacific, but
there was a one for like Canada, U.S., you know, the North Atlantic.
Okay, yeah, I'm not familiar with it, but yeah. So she saw that as sort of this process of interlocking nation states into a broader global system that would basically be facilitated through the UN and the IMF and the World Bank and World Health Organization in partnership with these other companies.
Wow. Well, I think we're going to wrap up this segment. We will continue the conversation in, you can go to CourtneyTurner.com and you can check out the Worldwide Radio Hour on WWCR Mondays at this time weekly. And we'll be back. You can go to CourtneyTurner.com. That's CourtneyTurner.com. And you'll hear the rest of this conversation. We will continue. I have a lot more questions, and we'll talk about school choice and Charlotte Isabeat. Thank you. All right. So we'll continue. This is a continuation from the Radio Hour. I'm here with John Klasik. He is the author of School World Order. And we're talking right now about Charlotte Isabeat and her vision for essentially what all these futurist geopolitical architects, you know, like Kissinger and Brzezinski, how they talked about there would be this dissolution of nation states and remnants of kind of power blocks. And it sounds like that she very much saw that even back then.
Yeah, I wanted to note this because we were talking about all the military connections.
Yeah.
Douglas Noble, not sure if he's still around, wrote a lot about it. So on page 315 of my book, there's a couple passages I quoted from him. So it says, so this is in a piece he wrote entitled Education, Technology, and the Military. And so the quote goes like this: a new discipline, human engineering or psychotechnology, emerged within military research during World War II. This work in the Army Air Force Aviation Psychology Program and the Implied Psychology Panel paralleled theoretical developments in information theory and cybernetics by wedding engineering and psychology into a study of human factors and machine design. If human factors engineering was the design of machines to fit men, training was the design of men to fit machines. During the war, educators and experimental psychologists mounted a massive effort in training, research, and development, influenced heavily by behaviorist learning psychology and emerging technologies such as film and automatic instructional devices. Although no curriculum atom bombs, in quotes, emerged from wartime training research and practice, an enormous intensification of interest was seen in the use of behaviorally oriented instructional objectives, task analysis, training aids, and simulations. And then he goes on to say that he details the specific contributions of the Army's Human Resources Research Office, HELMRO, the Air Force Personnel and Training Center, the American Institute for Research, and the RAND Corporation, mm-hmm. Offshoot System Development Corporation, military training technologies that were actually disseminated within an emerging federal effort to reform public education, so on and so forth. So he goes, there's that's worth a read. I got it. Like I said, I've got it excerpted in the book, but the whole thing is worth a read.
American Institute for Social Research or just research?
American Institute for Research, AIR, okay. A-I-R.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it's worth noting here that HUMRO and the Office of the Navy and Air Force were also involved in putting together an anthology of program. It was called it's either Programmed Learning or Programmed Instruction in. That's me.
Oh, I
think it is.
Oh, awesome.
I called him on the way when I was driving here. And
who?
Pasta.
Oh.
Crazy pasta.
Yeah. Jesus.
Sorry about that. It's like program learning and in something instruction. I'm getting it mixed up. But it's an anthology on, if you go to my article, NEA World Order at Unlimited Hangout, you can get a link to it there and the title's there. But all these military agencies were involved in financing this project, and also involved with it was the NEA's Department of Audiovisual Instructions. And the anthology included work from B.F. Skinner, Sidney L. Pressey, Robert Glazer, right? These people were all rock stars in programmed instruction.
Yeah.
So it's just more, right? More military connections to all this ed tech stuff.
Well, military and brainwashing. It just, the more and more I like dive into this type of research, the more it just really looks like the whole field of social science was created for it to be for really weaponized for like military research that does beta testing that they can then weaponize on the masses for control.
Yeah, I mean, not to sound overly conspiratorial, but I mean, it's hard to not consider that the target is our own citizens, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're like the primary target. And, you know, I mean, the way things have developed with the national security state, I mean, we see that, right, after the J6, right? I mean, they came out with that document that basically anybody can be a terrorist, right? If you're too far left, if you're too far right, you know, if you have strong feelings on either end about race or gender, the environment, or government, business, pretty much any opinion that doesn't,
it's inconvenient for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. Right. And so you see something like that now, where we are now. And you look back at stuff like this, and you have to kind of think that, right, that it didn't, it's not a coincidence that all of this programming and planning and financing culminates, or, you know, then this other thing happens disparately, right? Like there's a clearly what appears to be a deliberate connection. Right?
Yeah, it does look that way. I thought it was really interesting in Sutton's book. He talks about he has two points where he mentions in that chapter on how the order controls education, and at one point he says how they he feels like more research needs to be done about the connection between the order and the Illuminati, and then in it was like a few pages later he says in my next book, and he never I'm curious if there was ever. I mean, there was another book that I know of, but I don't know if, you know, anybody found any kind of notes, or was he working on it?
Not that I know of. Okay. So the only other things that I know that he wrote about the order were written in partnership with a project that my publisher put together. So Chris Milligan, Trine Day Books. So for people who don't know, he basically rescued Anthony Sutton's Introduction to the Order, Skull and Bones from the dust heap of history.
Your
right?
Publisher?
Yeah, Chris Milligan.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
yeah. You should get him on.
I would love to.
He's a really, really cool guy, man.
Okay, yeah, I would love that.
Yeah, and Charlotte knew him too.
Okay.
And he was a big Sutton. Actually, so I drove up there. He lives in Oregon. Okay. And I went up there. He has some of Sutton's files, but not the Skull and Bones stuff.
Okay.
Okay, the Skull and Bones stuff, I think, went into... So when he passed away, a lot of his stuff, except for the stuff that Chris had, just was basically taken by the state, basically. Some of it he left to his significant other at the time. And she was scared of it, so she gave it to Chris. Okay, and this was the stuff. So I went there, and it was a file cabinet full. It wasn't like Charlotte's, like a barn filled with it, literally from wall to wall. but Sutton was like Chris's, you know, it's like one of Chris's heroes. And so when Chris started publishing, first book he published was Barry and the Boys. That's the book about you know, the whole thing. They made a movie about it. You know, Barry Seal, Iran-Contra, drug smuggling, right? And and then, but later on, shortly thereafter, he got a hold of Sutton. But Chris's okay, so Chris's dad was in the OSS. And he was also a CIA later.
Right, yeah, sure.
I think it was like G6 or G4, G5, whatever. I can't remember the number. I think it's another military intelligence outfit. And actually, interestingly enough, at one point when he was, I don't know if it was under what capacity, and you know, in terms of OSS, CIA or whatever, but he was working at the Library of Congress under Archibald MacLeish. Archibald MacLeish was a member of the Order of Skull and Bones. He wrote the Constitution, or helped write the Constitution for UNESCO. Okay. But Chris somehow found Sutton, and he said when he found him on lab. I have some of the emails between them. Charlotte, she kept everything. Like, and she said, like, the family sometimes was like, why do you keep saving this? Are you going to get rid of this stuff? And there was a barn fire one year. So some of the papers I have like burned edges.
Oh, wow.
And I remember, you know, she kept telling me, she was like, they kept telling me to get rid of it. She was like, I think I kept it for you. you know, it was just like, she was like, why did I keep that for so long? Like, well, here it is. And, you know, when she was passing away, and I was there, you know, I spent the last weeks with her, and she was saying, like, she's like, they would just love for me to just go away. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Charlotte, you know, I got all your files, all your stuff. I said, as long as I'm alive, you're never going to go away. And she just smiled. She said, we laid there and then smiled. But Chris contacted Sutton, and Sutton said, the email said something like, how'd you find me? Only people with, you know, three-letter agencies know how to find me or whatever. So, you know, so Chris kind of had a little bit of that background from his dad. He didn't know it all his whole life, but they published a book called Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Okay. And it's like an anthology. Chris wrote a piece in it. Sutton wrote a few. I think Anton Chaitkin is in it. He was a LaRouche guy. I think he's still around. Tarpley might have an article in there too. Webster Tarpley. So your question was, did he? Some of that might have went into that.
Okay. Maybe,
but there's not a like a whole other book. It's just
right. I'd have to look into that. I thought it was very interesting because he seemed to he didn't want to overstate, you know, the thesis, but
yeah,
he definitely drew, even in the Order of Skull and Bones, drew some, you know, very specific parallels and connections with specific names. It does seem like, and the mission seems very aligned between the two.
Well, there's definitely, like, I would, right. Is the order like the direct,
like
institutional, right? Possibly, right. But at the very least, right? I mean, the Illuminati itself, right, you know, infiltrated the lodges, and I'm sure several other models like the same thing, but maybe at a different lodge or under a different name.
Well, we know
the same
they had
project,
offshoot groups. Basically. I mean, the League of the Outlaws became the League of the Just, which became the Communist League. So, I mean, we know that, and we know where that went. So that's not a secret.
Yeah, and so the way he traces it back has to do with there's a D and a P number. This is an interesting story too. So there's a D and a P number on some of the rosters.
Okay.
Now, when I was first looking through it, because I have the actual address books, one day I wanted to share a picture of. So they all get everybody in the Order of Skull and Bones gets a grandfather clock.
Right. Yeah. So Charlotte talked about that.
Sam was
and it in. Always had to be 5 minutes ahead.
Yeah, it's like to suggest that they're ahead of everybody, mm-hmm, right? They're a step ahead of them. I wound it one time. It still worked, but she typically didn't keep it wound. And Sam was, he offered to give it to me when she passed away. He was like, he was like not proud of the whole Skull and Bones thing. Right. As far as,
like, I want no part of this.
Yeah, I mean, he gave it to somebody. Part of me was like, kind of would have been cool, but it's spooky. Like, even when I wound it, was kind of like, am I gonna like release
kind of
some
energy?
Kind of
woo
woo or something out of it, you know? But there's it. So on the pendulum, okay, there is a D and a P.
Okay,
and I remember I wanted to post something about it. I took a picture of myself in front of it before I left. I couldn't remember. If it was a D or a C. So I'm going to look in Sutton's thing. He says D and P. So I'm looking up. The catalogs that I have don't have D and P numbers on them.
Okay.
Okay. So if you look in Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, he's got photocopy facsimiles of the catalogs. Mm-hmm. But then he's got another one. So the catalogs is in like a Times New Roman font.
Right.
There's another roster that he has from a year. So the catalogs Charlotte gave, one was from 1971, okay, and then there was another one from 83. And the 83 one was broken into, so usually they log together living and dead members. 83, this was the one when she tells the story that when she got the books, her dad was like, well, they never done that before, which was they separated the living and the dead. They bound them separately. And that was 83. I want to say it's 83, but it's the year, it's the next year, the year after that Stephen Mnuchin was in the order. And Sutton in the book has a facsimile of a roster that's in like old English calligraphy, mm-hmm, and that has the D and the P number on it. And I asked Chris, I said, well, where did he get this from?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't know, he probably did archival research at Yale. You could ask for RTA Corporation. So that's the Russell Trust Association. Mm-hmm. Russell Trust is the formal.
Daniel Coit Gilman created it, was tasked with organizing it,
right? Yeah. And they made that trust several years after they had been around, right? So I want to say maybe at least a decade or so, but then they formalized it into the trust, and that's the RTA Corporation. And they do have some records at Yale, so that's what I'm guessing. Patrick Wood, mm-hmm, who worked with Sutton, they wrote the Trilaterals over Washington. They said that they used to call Anthony the Hoover vacuum cleaner when he was at the Hoover Institute because he could find anything. And the only thing you got to understand, this is back when
you didn't have like the internet like you do today. Yeah. You didn't have social media. There was no Google.
Well, he was a production engineer, which I always thought he was just a historian or an economist, like an academic. I saw his dissertation at Chris's, and it was on like airlines. And so production engineering, if people don't know, it's like it's from natural resources extraction all the way to manufacturing, all the way to distribution, like all the things you need to do. That's a production engineer.
Wow.
And so
every step of like tactical operation.
Right. Yeah. And so you have to be very interdisciplinary to understand all that. And this is how I'm inferring that this is how he gained his Hoover abilities, right?
Yeah.
Is it because he knew where to look, who to write, what to ask,
and how to synthesize it, see where the connections would be.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't say exactly where he got it, but he probably went to the archives somehow. So, all that is to say that if you look at the D and the P, so it's a decade,
mm-hmm,
and then the P is the period, and it can't. Remember the exact numbers, but if you trace it back to the beginning of it, you're like a decade. Like, when was the first branch of the second period being the first period being ostensibly the Illuminati,
right?
The second period being the Order of Skull and Bones. You're only like a decade or so, right? So there's like a basically ostensibly there's a dark period, And then they pop back up. But there was other things like there were people that broke into the what they call the tomb or the temple. They were called the Order of the File and Claw because they used a file and a claw to break in.
Right.
And they took, I don't know if they took photos, but they did bring some artifact out. They drew a map of the interior. And all this is in the in Sutton's book. Mm-hmm. I forgot where I was going with that.
The connection.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a pad. There's something like a plaque or something in there that has a passage that's basically taken from John Robison's
Proofs of a Conspiracy.
That passage from Proofs of Conspiracy, Robison got from the documents that were confiscated by the Elector of Bavaria when the courier got caught, and then after they raided everybody's stuff, and so he got
when the guy who was killed was carrying like a bunch of their files,
right. And then I think
the Bavarian government had it.
Yeah, and then I think they went and, you know, like, confiscated people's property that their names were on the list, knocked on the door, and got more stuff. And, so the passage in there is something like matters. There's like a sword, a crown, and a skull, or there's these three things, and they represent, like, different classes, you know, like from the beggar to the king, and it's something like it doesn't... The phrase is something like matters not only, you know, we're all the same in death or something like that. And then this is sort of where the death cult aspect of the order, which Anthony says sometimes they refer to themselves as the Brotherhood of Death, sort of is that sort of a trope that they use for whatever sort of rituals they do for initiation, et cetera. So that's the other connection. And then there's others, like it's a German, right? The original we know is the German chapter. So there was, I don't know what you'd call it, like a business card or a calling card, but somewhere in there they found, either a photo or a card or both of them together, says DC Gilman of the German chapter and things. So those are the connections, right? You can trace it back.
The German chapter of the Illuminati,
of the order.
Oh, interesting. Because they in at least in the Order of Skull and Bones, that book, he says that Gilman was never actually in it, but like all of his relatives were. But he was tasked with creating the trust.
Gilman? No, he was.
He was
for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're.
I thought you said he wasn't actually.
No, Gilman was. He was
definitely.
He was a treasurer. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
he was a treasurer, okay.
And then he's the one that did the incorporation. He was one of the most active, especially in education, right?
Yeah, I remember that he incorporated that whole letter about like he felt like that was his mission in life. I'm talking to his, like a letter to his sister or something.
Yeah, and he, so we know that he set up, some of the first big colleges: Johns Hopkins, mm-hmm. Cornell, and UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. But he's also the first president, I think, of the Carnegie Institution of Washington, the one that was in the eugenics stuff,
right?
And he was also sat on the Rockefeller's General Education Board. I think he also had a role in the Peabody Fund or the Peabody Foundation, which was the first nonprofit, and it was for education,
right?
And, so I mean, he had his hands in
all over
much
the place.
Everything.
But
so those are the connections. Right. So it's known to be the origins are German. There's not much distance between the end of the Illuminati and the beginning of
Skull and Bones.
And then there's the that passage in there that is taken from or parallels Robeson's. Those are the main pieces of evidence that I can remember off the top of my head.
That's a lot. Yeah. It does seem like they're definitely connection. Yeah. Whether or not it's the exact continuation or not, I guess.
Yeah.
Would need to be further investigated, but it definitely does seem like the mission very aligned. So.
Yeah. And then the other connection is that they both come out of connected to basically
Prussia.
But universities. Right. So Weiss hopped out of Ingolstadt and then here out of Yale. Right. And you can kind of think of and Sutton does this very briefly in the beginning. If you don't know a lot about some of these other like Rhodes Society and Bilderberg, it's, mm-hmm. you don't really pick up on what he's kind of getting at right away, because it's sort of just context to get you into the stuff on the order. But in the first chapter or so, he talks about sort of the concentric circles and how the order sort of here in the middle, and then right outside of that you have like your round tables, your trilateral, mm-hmm. etc. and all that. He basically says that the Road Society is more or less a parallel model of, mm-hmm. right? It's just another one of these, right? It's a sort of a secret or secretive society in a university where people are sort of cultivated to take on the positions of what is now basically global governance, right? So right. These people would be the people that would go into your CFR, your trilateral, your Bilderberg, etc. And then from there, so they're like sort of incubation projects, right? And right. So that was another connection, was the sort of the university origins of it.
Right. And the whole, the indoctrination system through the universities.
Yeah.
So the Skull and Bones was the idea that it were all the same in death. That's part of why the death cult, that's what you were saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of, that's a trope. Okay. I'm not quite, it's kind of vague.
Sure.
I just thought of something, because uh-huh. I remember you were talking with, you did a show recently about this, and they were trying to figure out what the D meant. Right? Were you talking about that? Somebody mentioned Demosthenes when you were talking.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting story. Okay. So there might be something to that.
Okay.
Right? Because Sutton does have a couple of different theories about what the D and P necessarily mean. Right? So okay. One of them is the D and P, right?
Right.
Is what I just said about the dating. Charlotte told me that, because I mumble a lot. Like, uh-huh. I'm either really loud.
Right, right.
Or like I'm really, really quiet. And she'd be like, "You mumble." She was like, "You need to
enunciate."
She said, "You know what my dad used to tell me? He said, put two marbles in your mouth while you're and practice speaking." And she said he got that. That was Demosthenes that came up with that idea.
Ah,
you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of just a. It might not be anything to it, but it's interesting that
that is interesting.
Was like remembered. This thing that Demosthenes did, and Sutton says that, right? Because that he also is what was the history around Demosthenes? It said some correlate to sort of the end of democracy.
Well,
right?
Yeah, it was because the year 322 was in ancient Greece when it went from democracy to a plutocracy.
Okay, right. Okay, so and both of these things could basically. The DNP could be a dating, and they could also sort of have a dual meaning.
Well, it could be democracy to plutocracy.
Right, all these things, right?
Or it could be a triple entendre.
Yeah. I mean, and in the occult, like that's so it's very much way, right? It's rarely just a one-to-one sort of symbolism, right? I didn't mean to die, but when you said that, because I always remember that. And I told her that. I was like, did you know that in Sutton? She was like, oh, okay. So
that is really interesting. I mean, the whole idea of democracy to plutocracy does kind of make sense with their plans. I mean, that's... for the global governance, I mean, I think democracy is kind of a false, not in ancient Greece, but, these days that it's a false illusion. It's really, I think it's more of a marketing tactic to create the illusion of people having more power than they actually do, when in fact the term never implies that they really have the power at all. And then to be able to subvert that power into the plutocracy, which ultimately would be the technocracy. But
yeah, well, I mean, and then there's sort of like the parallels to the whole. I mean, I would say it's kind of like a combination between like a plutocracy or oligarchy and an aristocracy. And sort of the oligarchic part is sort of the means by which you can control this sort of pseudo democracy, right? So it's through the money that you can kind of engineer society, but it's through these ideas, right? These secret ideas. This would be the Aristos, right? Or sort of the best is what it really means. So they come up with the ideas, and then they use the financial system to basically control the people that think they're in a democracy.
I think that's right. It's interesting about aristocracy and this concept of aristocratic man, because it had a very different meaning in ancient times. It was this idea of being erudite and having a certain element of education in the genuine sense of the word, and wisdom, you know, combination thereof. And, you know, now today we think of it as somebody who has been, you know, part of a specific bloodline. And and that's really not what it meant. But I think that it's very interesting how that has been co-opted, because when you look at certainly this whole structure, whether it be through the secret society, the military industrial complex, you know, this oligarchy of financial institutions, what you do see is everybody who is part of this indoctrination system, where they become part of this elected groups to control and steer, they're either part of a bloodline, or they have been, you know, some sort of initiation through ritual.
Yeah, I mean, and so, right, like, nowadays, right, we kind of think of aristocracy as sort of this hereditary authority, right? And sort of the, you know, the whole class system of England and Europe more broadly.
Right.
And, you know, like, but in some way, right, there's people that have different theories about...
about the original intent?
Yeah, like some people think that, like, Karl Popper's one of them that thinks that Plato, like, actually wanted to do this stuff. But there's other people that think, like, it's a hypothetical, and, you know, it's a metaphor for, you know, the city is a metaphor of the human and the mind, and that it was, the whole idea was it was supposed to be meritocratic in the sense that if you could learn these things, then you should be given... an appropriate role in society, as opposed to, oh, you know, you've got all the money, so in an oligarchy, or you have all the military power in a democracy, right? I think I would lean towards Plato being kind of for it, just because of some of the other stuff, like the Timaeus and things like that.
Yeah.
And whether or not he was,
like,
we know that people today use that as a model. Like, if you look at Brave New World, there's tons of allusions to the Republic. H.G. Wells thought it was the model for what we should do, right? Like, so in Brave New World, instead of, you know, there's the parable of the metals in Plato's Republic, where he says that, right, the Aristos needs to breed these three different classes, and it's gold, bronze, silver, and it's basically, you know, intellectuals, military, and then they said husbandmen, and it's basically farmers and cattle ranchers, right? And he just so Huxley just switches that with alpha, beta, gamma, delta. And by the way, the Greek letters is an allusion to that, and it's a eugenic thing, but it's basically it's we're using modern biological theory as opposed to, you know, Plato's ideas. But so, so it still is, you know, whether or not, whatever Plato's position was, it's definitely a blueprint.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a blueprint. But I mean, there are so many that use blueprints that weren't ever necessarily intended to be a blueprint.
Yeah.
And I think in my large reason for believing that he genuinely wanted it to be the academy to be more of a meritocratic system is because the oligarchy and the powers that be back then were very similar, but they were kind of the descendants of the mystery schools, and it was very dark ritual occults. And I think he had to speak kind of in code in order to, right, in order to be able to have the academy, and in order to even, you know, do what he was trying to do.
Well, I mean, that was part of the reason why he always talked through Socrates, right? Because I didn't say this guy said it, right? You know, I'm just telling you what he said, right? And I think Thomas More kind of did something similar in Utopia.
Yeah,
right?
He did.
Guy's name is something like Nonsenso or something.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
and Socrates is very similar. I mean, he did everything by putting forth the most extreme, absurd case possible to prove his point. And he used a lot of satire and, you know, humor.
I think there
would be definitely a case to be made. Do we have any other documents you wanted to show, or do we go through?
Oh,
I think
we covered the big ones. There's one. This one's a kind of a gem. I do need to show. So this is... this is a symposium sponsored by the National Council on Education Research. It's April 24, 1986. And this is a meeting or a symposium content, character, and choice in schooling, public policy and research implications. Now, mm-hmm. if you look down at panel number two, you'll see that the NCER, National Council for Educational Research, council member is, let's see if I can get it all the way up in here. Oh, it just gets blurred. It's Donald Barr, all right? And I'll scan this. It's Donald Barr, right? And this is Bill Barr's daddy, and it's also the
guy who hired Epstein, the college dropout, to teach physics and math to high school students at Dalton.
Yeah, so he was running the Dalton School when Epstein was there, and mm-hmm. most people, we assume that, you know, especially at private schools, you know, that he would have had at least some knowledge over, probably some hand in hiring him. And you were telling me about the book that he wrote.
Yeah, really weird, so he wrote right? this book called Space Relations, and it's a very sci-fi, and it's kind of the aliens come in, and they organize this sex trafficking operation of humans. And the characters seem to have lots of similarities to people who we might call Epstein and Maxwell. But I think right after Epstein, like, only worked for maybe a year. I think it was a short period of time.
Okay.
And then he did this, like, I don't know if it was a hedge fund, some sort of financial institution managing, like, only multimillionaires.
Okay.
Which... typically, when you start out as an iBanker, you know, you're doing grunt work and you don't sleep. You sleep on the floor, like you're, you know, you, yeah, it's a...
well, it's similar to like his dollar...
but he's managing multimillionaires right out of the gate, you know. There's nothing shady about that.
Yeah, and then Lex Wexner gave him a property for a dollar, like some multi-million dollar property, right? And he was also Trilateral Commission, yep. CFR as well. I wrote about him long, long time ago before it was a popular
topic.
Yeah, before it was a TV topic. Well, there's a couple other things that I did want to tell. I mean, we don't have to go through the whole stack here, but what I had was sort of like a layout of sort of, oh, different school choice policies spanning. So we got Reagan administration here. This is sort of this is him. Well, actually, no, this is 1990. This is at this would have been H.W. Bush, but there's an mm-hmm. ALEC annual meeting. And this is sort of a school choice meeting here, mm-hmm. and the annual dinner is run by ALEC and ALEC. So it's the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're one of the big proponents of the funding charter schools and the public-private mm-hmm. partnerships. It was set up by, what's the guy's name? Not Ed Fulmer. That's the Heritage Foundation. Mm-hmm. But this guy, Paul Weyrich. Okay, Paul Weyrich, who was involved in setting up the Heritage Foundation. And also the American Legislative Exchange Council, also involved in Council for National Policy. And in my book, there's a whole...
all of these are known to be, quote-unquote, right-wing organizations. They appear to be very much controlled opposition organizations. Yeah.
So there's a whole, in the chapter on ALEC in here, we go through how they came up with this Virtual Public Schools Act. And this basically became, so what they do, they make draft legislation, they hand it out and basically use this to privatize, mm-hmm. You know, the various institutions. And so they had a whole program for education. So it's only a few years after that, the first official federal charter school legislation goes in. That's under Bill Clinton.
Right.
And so you know, it's the left wing, right, mm-hmm. guy that put in the first charter school legislation. Charter schools boomed under Obama. So the guy that he hired was Arne Duncan. Arne Duncan basically, he got into the department based on his role as the head of CPS, Chicago Public School Systems. And while he was there, he set up all sorts of charter school and other school choice programs. And the first article I wrote actually shows that, you know, there's a quote in there from Rauner, where it was suggested that they were that he had Duncan pull some strings to get his daughter into a special school. And he was like, I talk to Arne all the time, you know. Well, you probably would, because you guys are both big charter school folk, right? So it's just pretty much every administration from left to right
mm-hmm.
has pushed this in some degree or another, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess Biden hasn't really been on the school choice thing, but you know, his advisors have,
right?
So
To be fair, Biden's not really on much of anything right now.
not really.
He's trying to figure out which way he's walking and, yeah, what flavor of ice cream he's going to get. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty much all I had here on these was, it was just, you know, sort of a, rather than explicate each one, it was sort of a layout.
Yeah. You know. Well, I mean, it's fascinating. And I think that the key thing I really just think people need to take away is that, one, this has been in the works for so long, you know, the originators of this idea, really, whether they were directly or connected to, they subscribe to the model of Fabian socialist incrementalism. You know, so they laid the groundwork, they laid the foundation, they keep building on it. And then the other thing to take away is this is not, I had some people have come at me telling me that I must be brainwashed by Marxist propaganda because the left is not in favor of school choice. And they've seen that I've been talking about talking out against this, the policies that are being moved forth. Particularly, I'm trying to fight it locally because I feel like that's the only way we have much power to do so. And also because Tennessee does not have a whole lot of actual school choice. I mean, the homeschoolers are already very constricted. There's already a lot of regulation and controls on them, which is not the case in some states. In some states, when you homeschool your children, they are actually homeschooled, which means they are outside of the government system. And so these further measures and policies with the Education Freedom Scholarship Act are really, in my opinion, it looks like just an attempt to seize complete control over the very little bit of freedom that and parental rights that these homeschoolers, particularly in the category 4, have. But the thing that people keep telling me is that because I'm speaking out against it, I must be brainwashed by Marxist left-wing propaganda because the Democrats are not in favor of school choice and it's the Republicans who are. And it, you know, as you can see from the origin, this goes back and forth, left and right. This was a lot of the momentum for this gained traction under Reagan, who is the darling of the Republicans. And so this is not a left-right issue. This is an issue to advance globalization, global governance, and to create a global, worldwide workforce where they're training these children to be a part of that. And there's something, there was an experiment done, and I think it was in the 80s, actually. It was under Tavistock. It was called the Smart Cards. Are you familiar with this? It was to kind of measure, find metrics for children at a very young age to see where they would fit into, you know, this workforce training.
Okay. Yeah, probably. And
then they would be given some sort of an ID, and without it, they couldn't be a part of it. Yeah, they had to.
Yeah, and they really piloted a lot of that stuff in, like, with at the business level first, like psychometrics for employee screening.
Yes.
But my and
the military, right? That whole what was it? The operation of something war boards. There was a whole. I think it was Operation War Boards training, and this was also done under Tavistock, but it was done in World War II, and okay. They did a whole psychological screening of the soldiers, and then they ended up using that in corporate.
I think it's starting to ring a bell. But you're also reminding me, Charlotte used to always rail about the human relations curriculum, and one of the pilots was called the MACOS curriculum, MACOS. Mm-hmm. And she just, one of the things she always remembered was like how they were, this is kind of a values clarification thing. So one of the things that, you know, it's like study these other cultures from this valueless neutral position. Mm-hmm. So that it's like, you don't judge it based on your own values. Just, you know, this is their culture type thing. They were looking at how the Inuits, when somebody gets old, they would go out and freeze. You'd go out into the family would let them go out and freeze, you know, right. Because I mean, you're out there, you can't carry them with all the time. And, you know, Charlotte saw that basically as sort of like a subtle way to sort of prime people to be okay with euthanasia, right? But well, you know, other cultures do it, and you know, it's been happening. You know, it's like a historical thing, and you know, but you mentioned the homeschool thing. I did want to touch on that.
Yeah.
So this is a document, Educational Leadership. So this is a journal. I don't know if you can much of it. Well, you can see. And so I'll just read you some of the titles here.
Okay.
So a gem of choice. How did you say the Gateway program we were talking about earlier?
No, that's funny though. We were talking last night about the Gates program. Gates.
Okay, all right. I was like, hey,
talented education, okay. Which was part of a CIA okay. program. But that's funny. I've heard of the Gateway program, but I don't remember what that one is.
Okay, it wouldn't have rang. I wouldn't have noticed yeah. it too if we hadn't talked.
That's funny.
So, the promise of charter schools, charters as an innovation invitation. Can't read invitation to change. A progress report on California's charter schools, how to plan a charter school, and then the next ones are why parents choose homeschooling, perspectives from a homeschooling educator, homeschoolers as public school tutors, a homeschool district partnership, right? So you see that mixed in here with this, all these pro school choice articles, we have basically proposals for ways to integrate homeschools into the public system, right? And it's not necessarily tying the two together, but right. you can see that they're right on sort of the same platter
yeah.
and it's part of the same project. And actually, I brought some of this. She had some stuff from, here's one. This is.
The Gateway project was a CIA project also though.
Okay.
And it was, let's see, this is really small, so I'll see if I can read it. You tasked me to provide an assessment of the Gateway experience in terms of its mechanisms and ultimate practicality. I won't read all of this. Let me see if I can find a summary of it. It says, I began the narrative by briefly profiling fundamental biomedical factors affecting such related techniques as hypnosis. Yeah,
that's oh wow! Yeah, oh wow! I gotta check project. That out, and I'm glad I mentioned it.
Yeah. So this is what says the summary of the Gateway project. Fundamentally, the Gateway experience is a training system designed to bring enhanced strength, focus, and coherence, and amplitude of frequency of brainwave between the left and right hemisphere, as so to alter consciousness, moving it outside the physical sphere.
Wait,
so
I think this is the thing on HemiThink, right? Like it's. I don't know that it's the same thing. You know what I'm talking about?
I think you're right. This is the HemiSync. I think that's exactly what it is. It was a training system designed by the Monroe Institute. Yeah.
Okay.
But I know what you're saying. The HemiSync is the left-right brain hemisphere.
Yeah, it's got all kind of weird sort of new age occult kind of undertones mm-hmm. to it. But yeah, and there was this thing called reality shifting that kids got into really heavily. It spiked, like, you know, the Google Analytics during COVID where and the kids that do this, a friend of mine who has kids told me about this.
Okay.
This is how I looked at, there's scholarly papers on reality shifting that you can look this up.
Oh, yeah. So well, what they do remote viewing under the CIA too. Yeah.
It's basically the same idea, except like they do like automatic writing, and if you could make a script of mm-hmm. some fantasy you want to have, and you okay. do this HemiSync thing either with binaural frequencies and some kind of meditation or breathing, and you can live out this script. You can have like some sort of a out of body, you know, it's not remote viewing, like you're gonna right. you're looking at something in actual planet Earth, but you're not looking at reality either. You're not looking at yeah. what's in front of you either. This is from the Oregonian. This is 1994. So this okay. is a little project called the Learning Link. And so they wanted to basically find ways, again, to integrate homeschoolers into the public system. So if you were homeschooling, you could go to this hub that had computers. So they had a computer mm-hmm. lab, but then yeah. obviously, right, you had to sign up with the district and all that. Mm-hmm. So like early on, we've had all of these programs or policies to integrate not just private school, but right. homeschooling into it. And one of the main target audiences has tended to be the Christian community.
Yeah.
Right? And because I think they knew that demographically that, right, the yeah. values clarification, what we now call woke, the first people that are going to want to jump out of that ship are going to be people with Christian values, or at least some traditional values, and
right.
the bulk of that demographically in the United States would have been Christian at the time, right?
Yeah.
And so you can see here, I've got some flyers for something called the School of Tomorrow.
This I remember is, that.
Okay.
Yes.
What year is this? So some of the people in here are still going on. See this Abeka Books or Abeka Correspondence? They spell it differently now. They spell it, I think it's one word. It might be with two C's, but it's still, and I looked it up. It was started in the 70s, and they do online stuff from largely a Christian perspective. And here's a similar thing. Oh, it's another school for tomorrow, right? And so this would be another way to integrate the ed tech, the homeschooling into, right, especially if they were to receive vouchers or something like this. Now you've got the federal government in the homeschooling with the technology.
Right.
And one more thing that's worth noting is because it's, you know, she underlined here, it says it's a worldwide, right? Worldwide curriculum. Okay. And so in the stack she had here, I don't know what this is from. So at the top it just says Congressional Clearinghouse on the Future. So this must have been just some of a white paper that they published for this. So the Congressional Clearinghouse, I've got another document in my database where they were partnering with the Atari Corporation for like technology stuff. And the project was called FEAR, F-E-A-R. And I can't remember what the acronym stands
for. I can't either. I've heard this one before.
Of all the things to name something for education. So there's a proposal in here for a quote, World Computer Center, a World Computer Center. Okay. Now you also see down here, there's an article. I've only got an excerpt from it, but there's an article covering the Fourth General Assembly of the World Future Society. This is a 1982 document. Now, if you look at who's on this, who's on the board of this, we've got both Al Gore, probably can't see it, and also on the executive committee is Newt Gingrich. Both of them futurists, right? Yep. Gingrich wrote a foreword to one of Alvin Toffler's book, Alvin Toffler, Part of the World Future Society. And there's a quote in here where she's got it marked. That was one of the beautiful things about all these files was she highlighted stuff. So yeah, it's like I can zoom in on the key stuff right away. So in this passage, it says, it has become equally obvious that nothing constructive can be accomplished in the third world by endowing it with the kind of plants and factories that have, in other times, created wealth and jobs in our own societies. Such factories will henceforth be populated largely by robots or else go down to bankruptcy. Right? This is 1982, right? With a congressional clearinghouse for the future with two futurists, one from the left, one from the right, involved. And that's worth noting because she also noted here, this is something that somebody wrote her. The woman's name is Dana Horde. I don't know who she was. I know who Mary Thompson was. I never met her, but this Dana, I don't know who she was.
Okay.
But they note in here that she's talking about Rand Corporation, some of the stuff that we already went over. But she mentioned somebody, Jim Spady. It's not no relation to Bill Spady. Bill Spady was the guy that ran the Far West Regional Education Laboratory during the time of Project BEST. But this guy, Jim Spady, so she says, now this is not, I didn't look this up. Okay. I want to, but so right now this is just sort of an anecdote. Or I guess more or less an allegation that I'm trying to find. Basically she said that Jim Spady, there it is. So, because this woman that wrote this for Charlotte, I'll just read the beginning. Say, at the WA Statewide Education Coalition meeting, charter schools were discussed. The facilitator from Evergreen Freedom Foundation, which is linked to the Heritage Foundation, passed out a charter sheet. No sources listed, including this package. Notice the, and some of this stuff was from this package. Notice the language is identical to RAND Corporation. What are charter schools? Which define RAND's concept for effective schools. So she goes on and she's talking about through her interaction with these people that somebody told her, I'm not sure who she's talking here, somebody named Lynn, okay? And then she says, the following day, the Spadies held a meeting which was only to include supportive leadership. Fawn led the meeting. I think that's Jim Spady's wife. Fawn led the meeting because, quote, Jim and Richard are at the World Future Society Conference in Atlanta. And Jim Spady was also a speaker at the National Conference on School Choice, right? So again, you've got the very, I guess, I don't know if left is the right word, but right, the New Age Future, World Future Society. Oh, and also on this same conference with Jim Spady was somebody from the RAND Corporation, a Dr. Paul Hill, right? So we've sort of come back full circle to, right? We mentioned earlier that Reagan, mm-hmm. right, was also involved in this World Future Society at a time when they had this, the Esalen had this, the Soviet American exchange programs. And then you can see we have this Congressional Clearinghouse that ties in, right, this world computer system that could ostensibly be used to integrate the homeschools with the PPBS stuff from the Rand Corporation and so forth. So,
wow. I did look up while you were going through that. There's something called the Fear Project, and it's the fearproject.net. I don't know if this is the exact
is
same
Atari?
Thing that you were talking about. It says a Passair consultancy has almost 20 years experience working education, including schools, colleges, mentoring, coaching, careers, teaching, and delivering training conferences. So I don't know if it's the same.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah. I never bothered to look when I did look that up.
And this, it's the copyright is 2024. So, I mean, it could be an extension of, I don't know. But it does look interesting, worth further investigation. Wow. So, yeah, well, do we think that there's any hope of stopping any of this? Because... Well, I personally feel like they're really targeting. I understand this is a global agenda, but I feel like they are really, really targeting the United States. All the way from Wundt in the 1800s, it looks like there was a very clear agenda to. I think that's part of why, not that there aren't prestigious universities in other countries, Oxford, which also has their own secret societies. So there certainly are in other places, Ingolstadt, where, you know. Weishaupt from. So it's not that they aren't, but it seems like they were very intentional about creating this whole Ivy League consortium. That's really what it seems to be now in the United States, and creating that infrastructure for the deliberate dumbing down of America. And it seems like they've been so successful that Americans don't even see it. They're being completely blindsided. I'm not saying nobody does. I talk directly with many homeschool parents who are very wise to the whole agenda and the history, and they want to do everything possible to stop it. I feel like we slept for so long. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when a lot of the when people started going to the school boards, you know, mm-hmm. in the last couple of years, because, you know, with lockdowns, people and all the woke stuff, and they could see the curriculum and online and all that. That was a lot of people's first induction into any of this, right? But I'm glad we showed you, right? It goes way back, right? And I don't know. I mean, I think that strategically, you know, people become aware of what's happening. It's like a burning building, and you're trying to hurry up and run out. But don't, you know, I'm. How we react to it is going to sort of determine, right? Like it, and it's, I was talking with somebody at the conference last night, who was like pro school choice, right? Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, I rolled this out and was showing, you know, it was a good conversation. Awesome. It was cool. Like, and I could see him kind of like going like, we got to talk about this more, because like, you know, like he'd say, I'd show him this and I'd show him that. And, you know, as long as as long as you know, enough people don't jump into the charter schools, then we could buy time to maybe slow. I mean, insofar as we're just talking about the education front, as we've noted, right, this is integrated with everything, right? Everything. Stakeholder capitalism, the sustainable development, right? This is military, you know.
But this, I think, is focused on capturing the younger generation so they don't have to do all the other things to capture them. You know, they're already going to be groomed into this, you know, world training organization.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to I guess what I'm trying to get at, and I'm not being so articulate here, is that it's hard to convince people who go, look at what's going on in the public schools, mm-hmm. and they're like, well, this is a choice. This is something, this is something not that.
Right.
Right. Anything better than that. And you can, I would wager that in the early mm-hmm. phases, that the charter school, first of all, there'll be a little more flexibility in terms of curriculum.
Right.
And, you know, due to staffing, some of them are on lottery systems or whatever, but, you know, it might, you might have better outcomes. I hate that word because it's a loaded term pedagogically, but.
And he says that because Charlotte keeps talking about the result. What was it? Education-based outcome.
Oh, yeah. OBE. Yeah. Outcomes-based education. And it's, you know, by the way, I mean, it just ties directly into the PPBS, right? So you, instead of, you just take, instead of military outcomes or economic outcomes, you just turn that into education outcomes that serve the former two outcomes, right? And so it's also integrated with the Skinnerian method, because the idea is it's not about what the student knows in his or her head and the abstract knowledge, the ability to be creative, the ability to be able to follow your own curiosity and problem solve on your own. The outcome is student needs to be able to perform task X for, right, the whole PPBS system. So that's, again, right, it's, so the goal of education is to condition the student to perform outcomes. But you might get better outcomes in the charter school for a time to sort of, right, get everybody in it and build it. Like, think about early internet days, right? You know, like, back when, you know, anybody could start a YouTube and anybody could monetize and slowly, and then when enough people built the infrastructure and got, and the ecosystem became such that your livelihood was dependent on it.
Yeah.
Right. Now we can start to close the walls in and start to remove this and remove that and add this policy, add that regulation.
Right.
And so I would wager that, you know, it'll be enticing for now. And I don't know how easy it is to, you know, reach people that are, they just right now, all they can think about is I got to get out of the public school.
Yeah.
Right. So that's, to me, the danger. I don't know. I hope, hopefully this can reach people. You know, the only other alternative is very much, you know, it's you're not getting that federal. If you want to get out of the system, you're not getting that government money. You're gonna have to come up with a way,
and that doesn't mean just federal, that means it could be state money too, just government money, state as in, you know, the state government, not
and so, you know, that's that is also another sort of barrier, right? Because one is like, I want to get out of this thing and I'm in a hurry to get out of it, and the other one is, okay, it's like, okay, yeah, I agree, get out of it, but, and then you're like, don't take this money. And then it's like, so I have to do it all by myself, all on my own, with my own money, my own time, my own resources, which is another, right? It could be a disincentive, but you really got to think long-term, right? If you're thinking about, especially you're raising children, right? Yeah. Like, you're not, the goal isn't this year. It's not yes year. It's not middle school. It's not high. It's right. It's the child's whole life. Right.
Yeah.
And so if you get them into a decent school for a few years, but, you know, this basically further builds this global panopticon, you know, tyranny.
Yeah.
You know, what value did you gain, right? Because they had a better school for a time, but ended up right in the one system at the end of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all I know how to do is this.
Right.
It's throw, you know, information around and hope that it sticks. I mean, I'm always hopeful. You know, Charlotte fought it for, 50, you know, at least 50 years, you know, since the 70s.
She was amazing. I mean, she really was.
Oh, yeah. Man.
So much passion and so much guts. I mean, it was just almost like nothing scared her. Nothing was going to get her down. Nothing was getting in her way.
Yeah. No, and she was a blast, man.
She seemed like she'd be fun.
Oh, yeah. I had the best time with her, man. Yeah. So I appreciate being able to continue sharing her stuff, especially, and to remember people like Mary Thompson and some of her other, Barbara Morris is one of them. She wrote this piece on tax credits for tuition. There's another one. She said this was like her, one of Charlotte's heroes, somebody probably nobody's ever heard of. Her name was Maureen Heaton. And she wrote, you know, this is, there again, this was during the time we didn't have internet and things. So they would publish stuff like this, you know, pay for it out of pocket, right? And try to distribute it at conferences and things. And Maureen Heaton, I should scan this like soon. I have a copy of it. It's called The Impossible Dream. Actually, I think you can get it already at Sam's website, at Charlotte's Son. So that's AmericanDeception.com. And so, you know, best I can do is carry on, you know, what everybody, her and all her friends, you know, did that came before us. And, mm-hmm. You know, I got, you know, that's the way everything turned out. You know, I mean, I didn't, when I wrote this, I didn't know that I'd ever contact her. I didn't know right. I'd meet her. I didn't know I'd live there. I didn't know she'd give me everything. Like, I mean, that in itself gives me hope. Like, there's got to mm-hmm. be a reason, right? I don't think it was for naught. So, you know, hopefully God's hand is in this. So,
yeah. I mean, it seems a little too coincidental. Yeah, it's very special.
Well, the other thing people don't know is that she had, this is part of why I, you know, stayed there to help out, is she had a brain bleed, an aneurysm, like February-ish. No, maybe that's when I finally, she came. So it was shortly after I published, not long before COVID.
Okay.
And she had to have a hole drilled out of her skull to remove the, and she lived, she probably would have lived for to be 100 mm-hmm. if not. She, what had happened was she was on Eliquis. It's a blood thinner. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. They dosed it wrong. And she knew because she got all of the paperwork.
Right.
You know, she ordered it, and she used to keep, she said they were going to do an operation on her, and there was like the executive doctor and there's these other doctors, and they're like, let's wait to see if it goes down. Right. And the head doctor's like, no, we're taking it out now. And so she kept a picture of him, you know, on the mantle of this guy. I think because she lived, so she said, and she used to tell me this all the time, and I was like, I don't want to hear it. You know, she was like, when I die, and I'm like, no. I forgot what I was going with that. Sorry.
She was saying when she dies, and we were just talking about how, like, a little too coincidental.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what it was. So when she used to say, why did I come back? She was like, and then she's like, was it to give you all this stuff? Like, why, you know, but. Most people when that happens,
yeah.
Most people don't survive the surgery.
Right.
If you do, you only live a couple, most people, they're talking like 80-90%. The most you could, the record after that type of operation is like close to 2 years. That's about how long she lived. So what I'm saying is, you know, she was still that, and her mind was sharp. I mean, it wasn't as sharp as we did a little thing. I have to get it edited where she did like a memoir.
Oh, wow.
And we just sat down and talked, and she just did her life story. Like other neat stories that aren't like all this related to this, like her time in the overseas and stuff. But when I watched the video, I was like, oh, wow. I noticed it now. Cause I noticed she would get tired more mm-hmm. frequently. And at the time I was like, oh, wow. I didn't realize you know, how, but she, I think because she lasted that long after that, I feel like if she did Eliquis, then she didn't have that brain bleed, I feel like she probably would have still been going.
She was a powerhouse. Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful for the work that you've done, and to, you know, just share all of her legacy with us. And that's really, really special. As far as the hope for the future, I mean, I do see people fighting, but as you said, it's kind of like them running out of a burning building. They know the public schools are so incredibly destructive. They don't like what they're seeing in terms of the curriculum, the education, and just all the indoctrination. But I also think that unfortunately, my personal experience is that the politicians, the legislature, is so corrupt, and they are so... It seems like they're just like so determined to ram this through. I watched one of the subcommittee hearings, and it looks like they violated their own rules just to ram this through. It didn't look like they were really even listening to any of the opposition. You could kind of see the look on their face. They were just and I had personal meetings with these people, and they really weren't interested, and they placated us, but you know, you can tell that there's incentives, and the incentives must be very strong. I don't claim to know what's going on behind the scenes, other than that little leaked video from Phil on Twitter. You know, that seemed to be pretty strong evidence that there is some real strong levers of power on them. And that is my concern, because they're so effective at talking to people who don't really understand the history, and they don't understand the agenda So like you said, a lot of these parents will say, oh, but you know, it's choice outside. And the money is very enticing. And I understand that this is a really tough time for a lot of people, and especially for parents, and they've got to provide. And that, you know, we now have, and I think it's by design, we have the system where it's very hard to have a single parent working. So who's going to be home to do the homeschooling?
Right.
And then how do you have the resources, the textbooks, the materials to do the homeschooling? So, and I think that's all by design to force them into this system where they're dependent on some sort of government control. So I don't know. I think if I were to have any kind of say, and this is not for me to tell other people how to parent their kids, you know, that's for them to decide. But this idea that we need this formal education, I think is, I just don't think it's accurate. I one of the examples I actually used when I went to legislator was I was talking about our founding fathers. Most of them did not have formal education. You know, they wrote things like the Federalist Papers, which were considered fourth grade reading material at that time. I have sent this personally firsthand to friends of mine and people who I consider to be very erudite, intelligent people. This is not a dig at any of them. This is a commentary on our society. And they, if they were capable of reading it, they were not capable of comprehending it. And I understand the language has changed a bit, but I don't really think that's what it's indicative of. I think this is, you know, really reflective of the fact that we've been indoctrinated. They don't have, their attention spans have been, even people who can read and comprehend don't have the attention to do so. And that's, these people who wrote them were not formally educated. Most of them, you know, they may have read the Bible and that was kind of their foundation. Mm-hmm. They were intelligent. I would argue a lot of them were geniuses, but it's not because they had Ivy League education. And we see the converse true all the time too, where you have people who have had the best education possible and they underperform exceptionally, you know?
Yeah.
So So I would tell parents that, I'll just conclude with this. I think that I would tell parents that there's something called unschooling, mm-hmm. you know, and I think a lot of children actually learn more by watching. There's a reason why when school systems first were created, it was like a one room class, you know, it wasn't divided by grade. And the younger students learn so much from the older. And then there's just that innate kind of, you can call it competition, but it's really just this desire to want to be better. It's aspirational. Mm-hmm. And so they had something to aspire to. And I would argue in many ways that was a much better system. Yeah. So when you have unschooling or, you know, self-directed learning, you definitely give the child attention and tools, but you let them, you know, kind of figure out where their passions and talents lie. That doesn't mean you neglect whatever their weaknesses might be, but what are your thoughts on all that?
When you're talking young kids, basic literacy and numeracy, you know, not, and here's the thing, look, the statistics say, right, like, look, if you just read to them, sit down and read,
yes.
like, put the devices away as much as possible. This will help with the attention span, but, you know, model it, read with kids, right? You know, do alphabets, phonics, sound it out. They'll pick that. If you do that,
Don't do the look-say method,
the skull and bones method. And there's studies that say that, so if the students aren't literate or aren't up to speed by like third or fourth grade, that is the main determiner of how well they will do for the rest of their education.
Right.
So here's the thing, right? It's not that hard to get your children to read at a fourth grade. Literally just by sitting and reading and doing just phonics and sounding it out.
And by the way, modeling. I would say that I've also seen studies that have shown that, so they say by around fourth grade, which does not mean that somebody, because a lot of times, you know, if students are delayed, parents get very freaked out. That doesn't mean that if they catch up by fourth grade, they could be totally fine. They could end up being very advanced.
Sure.
So it doesn't have to, I'm not encouraging people wait, but it's just not to be freaked out. It's really more about by that time, right?
Yeah. And I guess what I was getting at is that window seems to work kind of both ways. Meaning if they are up to par by then, they can kind of start to do their own thing.
Right.
Like if they know how to sound the words out and look up in a dictionary and they can do basic, you know, basic math, count and stuff, like at that point, right. I mean, their own curiosity, is as long as they're not inundated with screens all day and don't want to do anything other than passively absorb media, right? Like they'll read the things they want to read. They'll right, try to, you know, maybe get into some tinkering engineering and, you know, and apply their math to that, you know. So, you know, I, you don't need a rigorous curriculum for the early phases. And, you know, hopefully, I mean, I've been trying to, I'm slow moving, but I'd like to develop some resources for homeschoolers and things like that for like high school and later for, you know, when they start to get into like, you know, classical rhetoric or maybe history of philosophy, that might be a place where some people might not feel like they know enough to be a guide for the student. But I said the early phases, you know, just read stuff that's fun to read and get them that basic literacy and numeracy. And I think at that point, if the, if you foster, you know, through the unschooling, the natural curiosity, you know, this is kind of getting back to like, this is the type of education that, the founding fathers and such had, So that, I guess that's a silver lining, Like, that part is actually not as difficult as you might think, you know?
And it doesn't require a whole lot of resources.
Right. You know,
I mean, just, if you think about parents just taking their children like to their day to day, like they take the children to the grocery store and let the kids kind of count up, you know, then they start to learn some math, you know, read the things on the labels and
all of that, Like anytime, you have an opportunity to like let the child sort of be involved in whatever you're doing, let them, you know, model and like, these are all learning opportunities, I mean, it's all applicable, So,
Well, thank you so much. Do you have anything else you want to impart? Please do.
I think we did.
Awesome. Well, thank you. This has been a real treat. And thank you all for listening and watching.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.